Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
He's heading your way again. Uncle Remus, the immortal storyteller in Walt Disney's honored motion picture classic. At last, Song of the South returns, rich in American folklore.
But just then, Brer Rabbit's tail snapped off real short.
Its warm live characters combined with the laughingest of all cartoon characters, known and loved today by everyone.
So long, Uncle Remus.
Sure hope you know what you was doing.
Don't worry about me. I can take care of myself.
Brer Rabbit, whose wits always keep him a hair away from the jaws of Brer Fox. And the bumbling Brer Bear.
Howdy, Brer Fox.
Get out of my trap!
Hey. Bubba. I'm gonna knock his head clean off. Hey, there ain't nothing in here except beans.
Once again, see all the fun with Uncle Remus.
How do you do?
Fine, how are you?
And his refreshing, timeless fables about critters that gently point up the foibles of folks.
That young scout was gonna put his foot in it one of these days.
Yeah!
Once again, feel all the powerful human drama. And once again, hear all the songs the world has never stopped singing about those zippity-doo-dah days.
Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it.
Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is my intrepid co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
That's right, Mr. White, and we're coming to the world from the most segregated city in America. That's Detroit.
This week, in honor of Black History Month, we are looking at the Walt Disney film Song of the South. Originally released in 1946, the film has been mired in controversy since its inception and is still something tricky to talk about today. Released in Hong Kong, Japan, and the UK, among other places, Song of the South was last released theatrically in the US in 1986, where it remains figuratively locked in the Disney vaults, maybe literally too, I don't know. What's the big deal? How did Song of the South come to be? And what the heck does zippity-doo-dah mean? We hope to answer those questions on this episode of the Projection Booth. So, Rob, how about summarizing the plot of Song of the South for our listeners?
Okay, so we get the feeling that Song of the South takes place sometime around the Civil War. We've been told from our folks that it actually takes place after the Civil War, which is when Joel Chandler Harris collected all of the Uncle Remus stories. So when the film opens, we see a family. It's a husband and wife and their kids, as well as, I believe, their domestic, who is traveling to see the grandmother at the old plantation, the family plantation. The mother, Sally, is played by Ruth Warwick, who you may not remember that name, but she played in Citizen Kane, played Charles Foster Kane's first wife. Hattie McDaniel, who is in Gone with the Wind and won an Oscar for that film, plays the domestic who's with them, and the two children, one of which is played by a relatively well-known child actor in the time in the 40s and 50s by the name of Bobby Driscoll, who plays the young Johnny. As for Uncle Remus himself, who shares the stories of Brer Rabbit, Brer Fox, and all the other animals, he's played by James Baskett. And basically what happens is the family is going, as I said, to the plantation to visit with grandmother. And we get this story of separation between the father and mother. I don't think it's ever really spelled out. It almost seems to me like maybe they're getting divorced or something's going on. So he takes off, and what happens is the two children go and have adventures with some of the other children that live in the community, both black and white. Johnny had heard about Uncle Remus and was looking forward to meeting him. So he meets him and he tells him these stories. And then throughout the plot, we get that, well, maybe the stories aren't good for him. Maybe they're leading him astray in some way. And in the end, we, of course, have a nice Disney wrap-up in terms of everything being good and well with the world, especially considering that when the film was made, it was a family film. So it was for children, and of course, Disney always aimed for children of all ages.
Yeah, you're right. I think they were getting divorced. There was this tension between the husband and the wife, which was kind of ironic because the guy playing the husband, Eric Rolfe, was actually married to Warwick in real life, and they were getting a divorce at that time. So that tension kind of comes through on screen, I think. They got divorced in July of 45, and the film was being shot in 1945. So yeah, there was that tension there, and he's barely in the story, really. So we kind of already have one of these missing parental figures, though the grandmother kind of takes over some of the parenting a little bit. She seems to be the voice of reason, her and Uncle Remus, I think.
Yeah, you almost get the feeling that Uncle Remus represents maybe a replacement father or grandfather in some way. And the thing that I find interesting is this is probably, I think, the first Disney film that even talks about such a separation of parents in such a way. I can't even think of a film in that era that would be, you know, considered a family film and a film for children that would even bring up the idea of divorce, even though I don't think they even say the word. It's sort of implied.
I believe that he's going away to make money to pay the people that are working on the farm, the farm hands, which used to be the slaves at that point. But again, not painfully obvious. I mean, I don't know. When I watch the film, I'm kind of there, like, waiting for the animated bits to come on.
Yeah, I think the film, on the whole, probably isn't one of the stronger Disney films. It's not one of the ones that really, from that era, from sort of the pre-50s era, that you would go back to. I mean, obviously, Pinocchio and Snow White and things like that, we go back to and really appreciate. I think it was Walt Disney and company trying to expand themselves in a different way and try to do some innovative stuff. But in terms of it being something that you'd want to go back and rewatch all the time, I just don't think it's there anymore.
So before we get into our discussion of the film, let's take a break here. We're going to play an interview that we did with Dr. Bruce Bickley, a scholar of Joel Chandler Harris, the writer of the Uncle Remus stories.
I'm Dr. Bruce Bickley, and I teach at Florida State University. I'm semi-retired, but still teaching for a graduate program we have in publishing and editing. Also teach occasional American literature courses and do community education courses in literature.
So how did you get into Joel Chandler Harris?
I had done a book on Herman Melville short fiction, and teaching at a Southern university, a growing up-and-coming university at Florida State, I wanted to get to know a Southern writer. Well, it turns out not a lot of work had been done on Harris, so I sent off some proposals and got a contract. That contract led to another contract, which led to another contract. Ended up doing several different kinds of books on Harris, starting with a pretty modest biography and critical study. But in doing the work on Harris's life and his legacy, I realized, oh my gosh, there's all this scholarship out there that nobody's ever really inventoried and summarized. And then I found all these reviews and essays about Harris over the years, on Harris, over the years that deserve reprinting, so I did that, and then that led to a whole series of projects. It's once you glom onto the Tar Baby, it's hard to get loose. And I found it really fascinating to deal with a white writer who's transmitting an important part of African American folklore to a mostly a white readership, because that was his readership in the 1880s when his Uncle Remus work started coming up, Brer Rabbit stories. But then, turning the century, he got to know Mark Twain. Twain's famous, of course, for his Portrait of Jim, and Huckleberry Finn. They were comparing notes about how you represent a person of color as a white author. And then that led to all kinds of controversies and affirmations, too, in our more recent times in the 20th century, mid-century especially, as critics started buying in and saying it was, you know, how accurate are these portraits of black character and who are these white guys trying to tell us about the black experience? And wow, so it's really, really fun.
For those who aren't familiar with Joel Chandler Harris, sort of beyond Uncle Remus, can you kind of give us an idea of who he was and for you, what really made him a compelling person, a compelling writer worth studying?
I first got to know Harris by reading a couple of Br'er Rabbit trickster stories in undergraduate school and a short story called Free Joe and the Rest of the World. Harris wrote four novels, several volumes of short stories, as well as the celebrated or by some vilified Uncle Remus stories. And I realized here's a Southern local colorist who was publishing in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, and into the turn of the century, who did a lot with poor white characters, as well as and free men of color, people of color, free people of color, black, you know, black people, male and female, as well as African-American folklore. And then he's a darn good journalist. He was the associate editor of the Atlanta Constitution for 24 years. And with Henry Grady, and Henry Grady has his problems, of course, because he was pretty racist, frankly. But the two of them opened up the South, helped open up the South and invite the Northern capital into the South to help reconstruct the region after the Civil War. And Henry Grady coined the phrase that he got from one of his sub-editors, the New South, and Harris was part of the New South movement. So the more I got into him, the more interesting he became. He's a humorist, a journalist, and a local color fiction writer, and a folklorist. So Katie barred the door, you know.
We both grew up in the North, and so we're not necessarily that familiar with Chandler Harris. It's kind of our understanding that the Uncle Remus stories are kind of, you know, along the same lines of Aesop's Fables and Grimm's Fairy Tales. Are they still as popular today, and what do they mean to Southern culture?
Harris revolutionized modern children's literature involving animal figures, because he made his Br'er Rabbit, Br'er Fox, Br'er Wolf, Br'er Terrapin so believable. They talk the same as folks. Br'er Rabbit smokes a cigar, sits in his rocking chair, reads a newspaper. Very anthropomorphized and believable folks like us, even though they're the critters, as Harris called them, or the creatures. But he helped us appreciate what children's literature could do to be less parable-like than Aesop's fables. And a whole series of children's book writers after Harris learned from him and even borrowed some of his characters' names, including Beatrice Potter, who asked her publisher, she was an English writer, of course, Peter Rabbit stories, "Do you think anybody would mind if I use some of these names that I got from Joel Chandler Harris's works?" And so he had this huge impact on children's writing. But what's fascinating about his stories is they operate on several levels simultaneously. These are not just entertaining animal stories. If you read them closely, and Harris's own introductions to his books explain this, that he got it. The weaker animal figures represent the black slave, surviving by his wits in a predatory world of white overseers and masters. And you have to use your thinking machine, as Br'er Rabbit calls it, to survive and endure in the face of this kind of brutality. And these stories are coded and multi-layered, and that's why I like them so much, because they work on several levels. Entertaining children's stories, read them in a group. Kids love the Tar Baby story. Kids love the Moon and the Mill Pond, where all the dumber animals walk into the pond and get wet while Br'er Rabbit's sitting on the shore and laughing because he's persuaded them that there's a pot of gold at the bottom of the pond, because when you have the moon over the pond, there's a reflection of the pond, and Br'er Rabbit says, "Well, that's that gold pot down there we've been looking for. Go get a seine and, you know, a net and pull it out," and so forth. So you have that kind of harmless entertainment. But then when you get inside the stories and you realize that it's a predatory world. And, for example, the most famous story he wrote was the Tar Baby story, which is a two-part story. And Uncle Remus, cagey old Uncle Remus, is the real trickster. He makes the little white boy, the son of the plantation owner where Remus is a slave, wait several days to hear the outcome of the Tar Tar Baby story. And meanwhile, the white boy has to internalize the lesson that Br'er Rabbit gets angry and starts punching out this Tar Baby because she won't talk to him. She won't be respectable to him. So he punches her with all four paws in his head, finally. And then Uncle Remus stops the story right there, and the little white boy says, well, Uncle Remus, did Br'er Rabbit get loose or not? Oh, I don't know. That's as far as the story goes. I think your mama's calling you for bed. See you later. And so several days later, literally, the boy says, well, now, Uncle Remus, what about Br'er Rabbit? Did he ever get free of the Tar Baby? Oh, laws, honey, didn't I tell you about that? I thought I told you about that. I must have dozed off that night. Then you find the reverse psychology where Br'er Fox can't decide how he's going to kill and eat Br'er Rabbit. I'm going to roast him. I'm going to hang him. I'm going to drown him. I don't have any string. There's no water nearby. I don't want to build a fire. That's too much trouble. And so Br'er Rabbit says, well, roast me, hang me, drown me. Just don't throw me in the briar patch. Well, I don't want to go there. So Br'er Fox says, that's it. I'll throw you in the briar patch. And, of course, that's where the rabbit thrives and lives, and no other animal can penetrate the briars. But roasting, hanging, and drowning, cutting off the ears, all the things that Br'er Fox thinks about doing are all punishments documented for runaway or disobedient slaves. So, whoops, this is a story the kids are laughing at, and we laugh at until we realize, oh, my goodness, these are coded stories about slavery and the horrors of slavery. So that's what brings me back to these 180-some-odd Uncle Remus stories, in addition to Harris's short fiction and novels.
You were saying that, you know, the stories themselves are dealing with code. As for the characters themselves and what they symbolize and their personalities, what do we sort of see as their sort of archetypal ideas or the things that they're trying to impart as characters?
Let's start with the larger animals, the supposedly stronger ones, Br'er Fox, Br'er Wolf, Br'er Bear, Br'er Buzzard. They love to hunt down rabbits. In one of Harris's stories, Br'er Wolf has been carrying off Br'er Rabbit's children and eating them. And Br'er Rabbit has to stop this nonsense. So he works out this famous way for luring Br'er Wolf into his rabbit hole, into his house, actually, and then trapping him in the chest and parboiling him alive with boiling water and calling the remaining baby rabbits, little rabbits, up from the basement or from the hole in the wall to witness the execution of the wolf out of sight inside the chest. But Br'er Rabbit has bored holes in the chest so the boiling water can sift through and parboil Br'er Wolf. So that's a way in the slave's imagination of getting even with mean overseers or master. So the larger animals are the overseers, the masters, the owners, the enslavers, and the seemingly weaker creatures in Harris's ideology and folklore iconography, which he got straight from African sources. The weaker creatures are the smarter ones because they survive by their wits. And when they have a chance to take revenge, they take revenge.
How much of these stories do you think were from the African sources and how much were from his own imagination?
This first two volumes, Uncle Remus' songs and his sayings and Nights with Uncle Remus, he tried to get two independent slave or former slaves, either slaves or former slaves, depending on when he collected the stories, to confirm these stories. He wanted to make sure that they were authentic. And he would use his own framework. He invented Uncle Remus based on two or three black slaves, former slaves that Harris knew. He gave, there was a gardener named Uncle Remus, a black gardener in Forsyth, Georgia, where Harris got Remus's name. But of course, it was popular for slave owners to name their slaves, ironically, tragically, with heroic names like Caesar, Pompey, Remus, Romulus. So that's where those names come from. So Harris picked that up from local sources. In his later works, he did a total of 7 Uncle Remus volumes before he died, and 3 more smaller volumes came out after he passed away in 1908. But later on, he invited his readers, both his newspaper readers, the Constitution and his reprints, and his popular fans, to send him stories they had heard from sources. And he'd reshape them and frame them, but we've done a study of his motifs. And something like 60% of the stories are based on African-American folk tales out of Senegal and Gambia, Senegambian tales where most of the African slaves were exported from the slave gate in Senegal that Bill Clinton visited several years ago and got photographed standing inside of. But these are Senegambian tales, and we can trace them back to African roots. Then some of Harris's stories he may have picked up in New Orleans when he lived in New Orleans and worked as a private secretary for an editor who's living in New Orleans. And he may have gotten some slaves there, some slave stories there, African-American stories there through some of the slaves. This would be after the Civil War in the early 70s or later 60s. He may have gotten some stories there from plantation tales that we know about. Laura Plantation, for example, L-A-U-R-A Plantation, was famous for its slave-telling story cycles. Slaves, that is, telling stories, animal fables. And some had echoes in American Indian folklore. Slaves and black slaves and American Indians intermarried, so there's a trickster figure in Western folklore who's the trickster is a rabbit. So we have that. You know, Harris also knows Caribbean folklore. He made quite a study of folklore. He realized these stories were really valuable, and somebody ought to write them down. And so he tried to immerse himself in the study of the folklore, African-American folklore, and learned about Aunt Nancy, Anansi, the spider woman trickster from Caribbean tales. So he had lots of sources.
When the tales were originally published in their era, and, I mean, obviously they were popular if they were going to put out that many volumes. What was the reaction at the time, and then what have you seen as, for your analysis, is why were they popular?
They were extremely popular because these are the first widespread printed versions of African-American animal tales, and nobody had ever seen anything quite like this. There had been smaller collections of African folk stories with really hard-to-read phonetics, and Harris made it. Patient enough with the first few stories, you can get his phonetic transcriptions and realize how to read these things out loud. It takes a little doing, but then you get the rhythm and they work. But Mark Twain and Joel Chandler Harris were America's two most popular writers in the 1880s through the early 20th century. And Harris died in 1908, and he at the time, the obituary said, the most beloved writer along with Mark Twain in America has just died, and then Twain would die 2 years later, 1910. Wildly popular. The print run sold out very quickly. It's hard to estimate how many. His story sold a million copies in various reprints, and they're still in multiple editions. You can go to Amazon, you can go to Barnes & Noble and do some keyword searches and see how many different editions of these stories are available with elaborate illustrations. Harris had a darn good illustrator, A.B. Frost, who was a noted American wildlife illustrator and hunting scenes illustrator, and also illustrated some Civil War stories. Harris brought him aboard to be his major illustrator starting in 1895 when he began to reprint his works. And Frost's drawings are his etchings, and his color washes are quite good. They're not really color so much as shades of gray, but they're very true to life. And Harris dressed his animals in vests and pants and never in shoes. Well, sometimes in shoes, and made them look semi-human. And of course, Disney bought all the rights to Harris's works in 1939 for $10,000. All his books, all his drawings, from Harris's children in 1939, and parlayed that into a multi-million-dollar sub-enterprise with the Splash Mountain theme park there as part of Disney World and here in Florida and also on the West Coast, and reprinted Harris's stories without Uncle Remus as a narrator, with a voiceover narrative with multicolored Great Western, I think Western or Golden Books. He'd come out with a new edition of the Tales of Brer Rabbit almost every year, starting in 1940 1946 when the movie Song of the South came out. He kept his Harris's stories in print. They're still in print in the simplified children's version. Harris's stuff was a source, a $10,000 investment by Disney, parlayed into multiple millions of happy Splash Mountain riders and readers of the Tales of Br'er Rabbit, not Uncle Remus's tales. Disney saw a good thing. He liked the highly animated, believable characters that Harris created and the clothing styles, and so his Disney's illustrators used A.B. Frost as a model as they began to craft the clothes and simplify the lines, of course, for the both for the movie and for the books.
So what is your take on Song of the South when it comes to the film adaptation of the stories?
Well, it's a Disneyfication, as it always does. It's much simplified. It's also, unfortunately, racialized, because the famous scenes of the slaves singing on the way to work to the fields and singing on the way home, Disney, after the NAACP protested, and a lot of other people did too in the late 40s about the movie, wanted it banned. Disney said, wait a minute, this movie was set after slavery. These aren't slaves. These are freed people going to work as tenant farmers or still working for, you know, on farms in the South. This is not set before emancipation. It doesn't come across that way. That's the problem. But when pressed, Disney said, no, I never intended it to be a portrait of slavery, of happy slaves. These are slaves, former slaves, going to work in fields now as free people. But that does not come across by any means. And Leonard Basket got an Academy Award for playing Uncle Remus in the movie, but in a private ceremony, because the Academy Awards were segregated in 1946 and for years afterwards. So he didn't get his Academy Award for a really good job he did, frankly, of portraying wise Uncle Remus, but also a stern Uncle Remus trying to help the kids that he comes in contact with be better citizens and understand also the ways of the world and use reverse psychology as a survival skill, just like Br'er Rabbit does.
The other thing that's interesting when I watch it is that the portrayal of the farmers, or, you know, the belief that these might be slaves or sharecroppers or whatever, is it the dialectic? Do you also find that the way the characters speak is also a little bit stereotype, or do you think that that was handled in a correct way because that's the way it was laid down within the stories?
Disney distorts that too. Linguists have studied Harris's stories starting in the 50s. They got really serious about looking at Harris's dialect, and it started earlier than that, really, but in the 50s, several good studies came out of Harris, and they realized he did a darn good job of differentiating black dialects from Middle Georgia. He also introduces the reader to some blacks from after the war now, from Savannah, who are cocky and arrogant and city slickers, and Uncle Remus is all put off by their smart ways. So Harris had differentiation of dialects really well, and he also did a great job with poor white dialects in his stories, because he has several stories about poor whites. And he had a good ear, and this is before we had electronic recording devices, and Harris took notes, and he actively gathered slave stories, animal stories from slaves, and later from stevedores, or I should say from railroad dockside workers in Norcross, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. He heard a number of railroad yard workers, station workers, talking and telling stories. And so Harris wrote later that he tossed out the Br'er Rabbit, the Tar Baby stories, as a feeler, and immediately got a lot more stories as the blacks started swapping stories back and forth and asking him, where'd you hear that story? Well, I know that story, and so forth. So he was trying to acquire stories all the time, and he tried to make the dialect accurate. Disney simplifies it. He makes Br'er Rabbit silly. He's a silly hero in the Song of the South. He talks too fast. He's too flippant, irritating. He's not really the cagey, more sophisticated Br'er Rabbit that you find in Harris's stories. He's kind of silly and flopsy, and there's a lot of slapstick humor in Disney's version of the stories that he retold five of the animated stories in the Song of the South. And the rest is real narrative, supposedly, you know, real people. We face the story scenes as Uncle Remus tells them. But Disney stylizes things as he always does and loses the sharper edges of discrimination and representation in the process. In Harris's second volume, you got four black narrators, not just Uncle Remus. Uncle Remus, Sis Tempe, who is the cook in the big house. This is still before, you know, during slavery. Then there's Tildy, the black house girl, who's about 19 or 17 maybe. Then there's Daddy Jack, from the Agulla black from the Sea Islands of Georgia. They all tell stories in Harris's second volume, Nights with Uncle Remus. And my son John and I edited that volume for Penguin Classics, for the Penguin Classics series, and it sold out right away. And we did a pretty good job, I think, with our introduction bibliography, because that's the real performance where Harris is trying to differentiate all these dialects. And by gosh, he did a good job. He even gives you a Gullah glossary so you can understand Daddy Jack's stories, because he's speaking in Gullah terminology. And Harris got that right. Really, really interesting. But Disney simplified and stylized and made the stories silly and slapsticky when they should have been more subtle. You know, typical Disney. But he kept the legacy going, even though Song of the South was re-released four times before it was pulled by Disney. And there's a movement on the West Coast and elsewhere to bring it back and try to understand and work with it some more. You can still get copies of it from suppliers and people who transcribed it, and a Japanese company puts it out with Japanese subtitles. It's kind of funny. So it's out there.
You think it's kind of odd that you have it available in other countries, but for some reason it's just too extreme or outrageous for us to have here in the States?
Yeah, I think we're afraid. I don't know why we're so afraid to deal with it. Just bring it out and we'll have a seminar about it and have at it, you know, and show you how Harris, what Disney did to Harris and for Harris in some ways. The Joel Chandler Harris Association is active. I've served on their board for several years. I rotated off recently because the Harris House in Atlanta, West End Atlanta, the Harris's big house, is nine. He had nine kids. Kept adding on to his house in West End Atlanta. It's a house museum, and it's been open since 1913. And it's a lot of good artifacts there. It's not the little slave cabin made into a micro museum in Eatonton, Georgia, where Harris was born. It's his house. For all those years, he lived in Atlanta as associate editor of the Constitution. It's definitely worth seeing, and you get a feel for the legacy there, too. And his typewriter, and his pictures on the wall, and personal artifacts that the Harris family had. It's on your historical tour. It's on all the Atlanta maps. It's the Wren's Nest, as it's called, as Harris called it, when Wren's moved into the mailbox. Just about 5 miles out of the center of Atlanta, there it is. It's off of Route 20, Interstate 20. It's well worth seeing. And then Harris spent 6 years as associate editor of the Savannah Morning News. I raised a little money and put up a marker to Harris's 6 years in Savannah. That's down there, right across from where the Morning News headquarters was all those years that Harris was there. They moved it to moved the paper to a bigger place now. But Harris lived in Savannah, met his wife-to-be, and they both lived in the Florida House, which is a rooming house, now merged with the Marshall House, because the buildings right next to each other. And when we dedicated the marker, 2003, my wife and I got to stay in Harris's actual bedroom in the former Florida House, now part of the Marshall House, and that was cool. Georgia has more historical markers than any other state in the Union, by the way. People are passionate about the multiplex history of that state.
You know, there's the troubling history of slavery, of course, and people don't really want to obviously look at Song of the South, or there seems to be a problem with that. Do you think that kind of the way that Song of the South has been buried in the United States kind of has overshadowed Chandler Harris as well? Do you think that some of the uncomfortable feelings that we have about race in America kind of push him to the side a little bit? Or
I think that's right. I think the fact that he was a white man retelling black folklore is a large part of it, because right away you're suspicious about his motives. Now, also born in Eatonton, Georgia, where Harris was born, is Alice Walker. And Alice Walker has published a couple of famous essays, the thrust of which is, Uncle Remus is no friend of mine. Here's a white man who stole my black folklore legacy and made a lot of money retelling those stories that were published by the white publishing enterprise for mostly white readers. And therefore, he makes me uncomfortable. I'm still mad about it. Toni Morrison heard the Uncle Remus stories. Let's say Toni Morrison heard the Brer Rabbit stories. She didn't read them or had them read to her from Harris's book, but they were out there, and she knows about them. And she has several Tar Baby figures in her fiction, including, of course, in the book Tar Baby. But that's part of the folklore iconography that she was aware of and heard as a black woman raised by literate parents who made sure she heard a lot of and read on her own and heard a lot of good literature about her tradition, her heritage. So you've actually got several Tar Baby figures and Morrison, but that's her drawing on, she's drawn on her legacy, not on Harris. She's drawn on her way from the same roots, of course, but filtered through different sources. But yes, this whole issue makes us uncomfortable. Harris makes Remus look at times prejudiced against smart blacks he doesn't like. He says, why do you want to, don't put a book in a, if you put a book in a slave's hand, you lose a field hand. He was not literate, and he resented the fact that he never had that ability, and therefore he's suspicious of blacks who are too smart for their own britches. So you have that going on. But at the same time, if you study Remus carefully enough, Harris's creation of this Remus character, he's the arch trickster. He's playing. He's dangling stories out there before us and saying, here, white reader, do you know what's going on in this story? Let's talk about this Tar Baby. Look at all those punishments that the Brer Fox threatens the rabbit with. Guess what? Those are real. Those happened, you know?
You know, you're talking about the trickster and the trickster rabbit, and I know that the trickster character has kind of gone through all of these different cultural myths and stories and all that. The thing that springs to mind is that I can see Bugs Bunny coming right from Brer Rabbit.
Now, I've said that in print a couple of times because there's so many similarities. The Warner Brothers Looney Tunes funnel is a little different from Disney's. Thank goodness, because I think they're more intelligent and craftier animal characters, really. But I can't believe that the creation of Bugs Bunny didn't have some Harris in mind, because Harris made the rabbit internationally famous, and Beatrix Potter stole characters from Harris, as I mentioned earlier. Winnie the Pooh, Milne owes a lot to Harris. This has been documented by a really strong book on folklore influences on children's literature. You have The Wind in the Willows, you have Charlotte's Web. The characters, the animal characters, are suddenly believable after Harris. People were reading Harris and realizing, you know, we can make these characters a little stronger and more identifiable with by humanizing them, as Harris did. And so that's part of his legacy, too. But slavery and anything about slaves, any kind of slang talk, you know, dialect talk, makes a lot of readers uncomfortable. But then again, you have to realize that a good folktale teller, whether literate or illiterate, adapts his stories to the audience. And so they're going to shift. There's no one Brer Rabbit story, Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby story. There's several versions of it, depending on the audience. You're always playing off the audience sensibilities. And Harris understood that. And that's one reason he experimented with four different black narrators to show the readership. Wait a minute, not just Uncle Remus out there, a lot of performers of folklore. Let's tune our ears to them and understand what they're really talking about.
I was going to ask, you know, today in our modern world, and we look at these stories or we share these stories now, how do you think we can look at them and appreciate them today as not dusty relics, but as actually something that might have something to say to us? And then at the same time, as we had discussed a little bit, how do we deal with these racial issues that some people feel about it?
I think you deal with it up front. You acknowledge, as I've been my writing about Harris, the controversies about Harris, the resistance to Harris, the troublesome components of his legacy. He tells racial jokes in his letters as an editor, and his correspondence and editor with the Atlanta Constitution and the Savannah Morning News as well. And he worked for several newspapers before he got to Atlanta, and where he stayed for his major years, almost a quarter of a century. And he told racial jokes, everybody did. He wanted to educate blacks. He wanted to see blacks educated. But he was not an integrationist. No, it's not. We're not ready for that. We should have good schooling, but that needs to be a separate system. So he was a progressive conservative, is what I call him in some of my writings. As close as I can get, he certainly had his prejudices. But boy, in some of his adult short stories, let's call them the short local color stories, like Mingo, for example. Here's a black carriage driver after slavery who's smarter than all the white people he deals with, the families he worked for before slavery, and still feels loyalty to after emancipation. And he has a real consciousness, the alertness there that they don't have, because they're still at war with each other for class reasons. A poor white boy marries the daughter vice versa, the daughter of a poor white woman marries a boy from a upstanding class. It's roughly, I can't pull it all back right now, but Mingo sees how these whites are at each other's throats for reasons of class and prejudice. That's not the way it should be. He tells us that. And Harris wrote several essays on the Negro problem, published in the Saturday Evening Post. He was seeing America coming out of the Civil War and Reconstruction now, which distorted things and caused all kinds of further erosion of values for a while in the South. And he's saying, we got to deal with this. We got to be brothers. We got to figure out a way to talk. We got to get these prejudices behind us. And we're a larger human race. An editor should have a purpose. An editor in the South should have a purpose to build what he called neighborliness. Let's at least be neighbors. Let's move forward now, you know.
And we're talking about Song of the South, based on the works of Joel Chandler Harris. The rights to those works were actually purchased by Walt Disney Company in 1939 for about $10,000, a pretty good investment, all things considered, when you look out through the years and all of the various things and ways in which Br'er Fox and Br'er Rabbit and all the Joel Chandler Harris characters that were collected in those folktales have been used by the Disney Company.
They are still really a part of Disney, even though they're kind of swept under the rug a little bit. It's kind of weird. There's like this embracing of the characters and a distancing from the film both at the same time. And we're really talking about the Br'er Rabbit, Br'er Fox, Br'er Bear characters. Uncle Remus really doesn't make too much of an appearance when we talk about, you know, let's go back and talk about zippity-doo-dah days and those kind of things. Even though he was the guy singing the song, we're looking at a lot of material. I just downloaded a read-along storybook, and, you know, Uncle Remus isn't there telling the story anymore. It's just a unknown narrator who is giving us the Tar Baby story. So he's kind of swept under the rug. The Brer animals are still in force.
And speaking of which, I mean, you want to talk about how the song, as we talked about, Zippity-Doo-Dah and all that stuff within the context of Song of the South, is still a major song within the Disney song catalog, in which it's one of those songs that people remember. They use it a lot at the park. They use it in various places. And then also, even as recent as the late 80s, with, as we were talking with Professor Vickley about the use of the Joel Chandler Harris characters that came out of these folktales that he collected, the Splash Mountain ride. And Splash Mountain was only created at Disneyland in 1989 and at the Magic Kingdom in Florida in 1992. So even though Song of the South, which these characters come out of within the Disney catalog, is no longer out there, at least in America, they're still inspired to use these things within their own theme parks and within what they do.
So let's talk a little bit about Uncle Remus. I mean, he is the wise old guy, and unfortunately, he could fit into this kind of, I believe that the term is mystical Negro school of films. I mean, the whole idea of Michael Clark Duncan in The Green Mile or Bagger Vance and Legend of Bagger Vance, the kind of thing where, hey, yeah, this stuff isn't going well with these white people, so we need a black guy to come along and save them. He's not necessarily a magical character, even though, well, I guess he kind of is, since he's there talking to animals and animated characters kind of jump out of the woodwork, that kind of stuff. Really kind of trippy when you think about it. But he seems to have a good grasp on reality and really seems to be very interested in helping out not just the Bobby Driscoll character, but pretty much everybody around him. He seems to want to kind of help out anyone and everyone that kind of comes in contact with him.
Yeah, and he's played very well by James Baskett. I mean, he did a really nice job playing the role. And the character, as you say, he's just this kind man. And I can see what you mean about him sort of fitting into the so-called magical Negro stereotype. He also seems to fit into what we'll also consider within Hollywood the idea of a black character who is an older black character and therefore some would say is not as threatening as a younger black character. Like, you couldn't have a person in their 20s or 30s that was a black man maybe doing these stories, and they might be seen as a little bit more threatening. It seems that black children or older black males seem to get more push within the cinema of mainstream than sort of folks our age.
Yeah, maybe LeVar Burton would be okay, but definitely not Ice Cube.
Yeah, exactly. So as for what he does, he tells these stories to the children, and we see them obviously in the animations. And I think that the animations are interesting because what we have is we have a combination of animation here where we have three full animated segments that are just the characters, just the animal characters themselves. And they're sort of woven into this storyline. Like I said, the plot's really kind of thin. It's more sort of a showcase to put these animated things in. And then we also have the mix of animation and live action, which I don't know. How do you feel in terms of looking at Disney's sort of catalog up to this point when we talk about, you know, 1946, how the animation is? Do you like the animation by itself and then sort of that mix of live action and animation? How do you think it works for you?
I wanted more animation, and I think that was kind of why this film didn't necessarily do as well at the box office the first time around as it could have, was that other people were kind of saying, I'm going to a Disney movie, I expect animation. This was really before the whole series of live action films. Obviously, we're, you know, 20 years before Herbie the Love Bug and many years before Pollyanna and all these kind of things. So people kind of associated Disney with animation. So I think folks were kind of looking forward to seeing more animated stuff. It's kind of funny. It reminds me of when I went to see Fantasia as a kid, and I was a movie snob even as a kid, of course. I'm sitting in this theater watching Fantasia, and this little kid behind me, maybe like 2 years younger than I am, just keeps going, "Where's Mickey Mouse? I want to see Mickey Mouse." And I'm just like, "Shut your mouth." This is great animation. Shut your mouth, kid. I don't care. about Mickey Mouse. I'm not sure which re-release that was. I want to say, I was probably 7 at the time, but I was already a movie snob. But as far as the actual technical mix of the animation and the live action, I think it's pretty remarkable. I mean, I've seen it before in other things, but I'm not sure exactly where those fall on the timeline. You've got Jerry from the Tom and Jerry cartoons dancing with Gene Kelly, and you've got other, live action stuff going on mixed with cartoons. I'm sure it went back really very far. I'm sure that there was stuff happening, as far back as the Betty Boop stuff, if not even before. So I am no expert when it comes to the history of animation in America or the world, of course. So I'm not sure where that begins, but I will say that they are blended very well in Song of the South. I like when we go from the one to the other. And I especially like that first one, that kind of Uncle Remus kind of almost exploding off the screen when he goes from this kind of drab antebellum setting of this plantation to this bright, bright animated world.
I agree with you on the animation and the mixing of the live action and all that. I thought it worked really well, and the colors are really beautiful. It was a Technicolor picture, and it looks really nice. And what's interesting is there's this quote that I found online related to Disney, and he was talking about the creation of the film. And what he was saying is that I guess there had been some discussion as far back, like we said, in 1939, they bought the rights to the Joel Chandler Harris stuff and were deciding on doing this. And there had been some discussion of, well, should we do it all animation? And what Disney said in this quote that I found, he says, "I always felt Uncle Remus should be played by a living person. And as should the young boy who Harris's old Negro philosopher relates his vivid stories of the Briar Patch. Several tests and previous pictures, especially of Three Caballeros, which was in 1944, were encouraging in a way of putting living action and animation dovetailing it together. Finally, a few months ago, we took our foot in hand, in the words of Uncle Remus, and jumped into our most venturesome, but also most pleasurable undertaking." Disney saw, as from the very beginning, that you needed to have a human telling these stories to the kid at the bare minimum. You needed Uncle Remus and the boy, and he's telling the stories, and then we can go into the animation. One of the things I thought was interesting in some of the reading that I did was that Disney had tried to get several different directors, including King Vidor at one point, to do a live action direction, but that didn't end up happening.
Yeah, and what I found fascinating too, you mentioned Citizen Kane a little bit earlier, that Ruth Warwick was in that, and this was cinematographer Greg Toland's first color film, I believe, so he kind of really came out swinging there. I mean, not only is he going to do a color film, but to do this incredibly colorful film and have to worry about the way that the live action and the animation are kind of going to have to match up. I mean, obviously, he didn't do cinematography on the purely animated parts, but to have that kind of extra kink of, okay, Greg, this is going to go into this animated sequence, so we need to make sure that this stuff matches. Obviously he's up for a challenge. If he's going to work with Orson Welles, he's up for a challenge.
It's interesting when we talk about Song of the South, of course, it's not available in the United States. You can get it in other places. But when the film came out in 1946, there was a reaction, much like when Birth of a Nation came out. There was the NAACP had just started a few years earlier, and it did come out against that film and was very much concerned about the image of black folks in that film. And the reaction I was able to find from the statement that was sent to the press from the NAACP in relation to Song of the South is pretty interesting. "Well, the National Association of Advancement of Colored People recognizes in Song of the South remarkable artistic merit in the music and in the combination of living actors and the cartoon technique. It regrets, however, that in an effort neither to offend audiences in the North or South, the production helps to perpetuate a dangerously glorified picture of slavery, making use of the beautiful Uncle Remus folklore. Song of the South unfortunately gives the impression of an idyllic master-slave relationship, which is in distortion of the facts." So that's what the NAACP felt about the film when they saw it. And as we discussed with the professor, Bruce Bickley, is that there's certain scenes within the film that can lead you to believe that this film actually takes place not after the war, but before the war.
Right. I think that is really one of the biggest failures of this film, is the way that they, I guess we could say, Disney was an expert when it came to animation. They weren't so good when it came to live action. So I don't know. Maybe it was the kind of failing of the live action storytelling, but they really don't do that good of a job to say, hey, this for sure is post-slavery time. All these folks are free to go. I mean, we do have Uncle Remus packing up and, you know, about to head out of town at one point where it's like, but at that point in the movie, I was like, whoa, hey, how can he do that? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. This is post-Civil War. But yeah, I don't know if it's just having Hattie McDaniel there or what it is, but it feels like this very like, yeah, we is all happy to have you around here, Massa, kind of stuff. And it's like, that really, you know, gets under your skin. And I think too, the way that people talk in the film also is one of the things that kind of gets to me as far as, you know, the white people all, you know, speak relatively good English, yada, yada. But when it comes to the black characters, they all speak with that kind of strong Ebonic effect to them. And it's like, oh, really? So that hurts whenever I see that.
And just cause DJ Tales is about critters like Bear Rabbit and Bear Fox, that don't mean they ain't the same like can happen to folks.
One of the things I found interesting when watching it, and I don't know if you noticed this as well, is that it appears that the animated animals actually have more of a stereotypic voice in that way, as you were talking about, more of a dialectic voice than Uncle Remus does. I mean, he does have a few words here and there that are like, oh, that's nice kind of thing, and you children and all that kind of thing. But it appears that like Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Fox and all them are very deep into that. They're very deep into sort of a stereotypical representation. And I can understand how that can be troubling.
Oh, keeping the crows out the cornfield. I's making $1 a minute.
$1 a minute?
Deed I is. Would you like to make $1 a minute, Brother Bear?
Yeah, but
you know, you'd make a mighty fine scarecrow, Brother Bear.
Thanks.
How'd you like to have this job?
I guess it's even more troubling because of what we spoke to Professor Bickley about was this whole idea of, well, maybe Br'er Fox and Br'er Bear could be stand-ins for overseers at times. So it doesn't really make sense then that they're suddenly cast in this more black role where it's, you know, black-on-black violence instead of it being like, okay, maybe you should have laid off the black dialect when it came to Br'er Bear and Br'er Fox, especially Br'er Fox, because he is... I will say he's a rather despicable character. There are really no redeeming qualities when it comes to Br'er Fox. And he's made to look a fool quite often, which is good. But really, again, it's a black character, it feels like, being made to look a fool. Yeah, I know he's an animated character. He's not black. He's not white. He's a damn fox. But the way that he speaks really comes out as if he sounds like he were black. So take that as you will.
You know, there are a few good things from a race standpoint in this film that I also want to highlight and kind of talk about as well. And I don't know if they are obvious to you or not, but a lot of it has to do with the relationship that centers around Johnny, played by Bobby Driscoll, and the young black child, Toby, the young black boy who's around as well, and kind of how they relate to each other.
His name is not Toby. His name is Kunta Kinte.
Well, maybe in the other film, but in this one, it's Toby.
Yeah, I like that. Even though we don't get a whole lot of Toby, we get more of Bobby Driscoll interacting with the little white girl and those two nasty white kids. I just wanted to wipe the floor with those kids. But it is nice that there is kind of this color blindness, let's say, when it comes to...
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.